Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And joining me now is Ira Glass, the creator and host of that public radio phenomenon, This American Life, which has won numerous honors, including a Peabody, a DuPont, Columbia, and the Robert F. Kennedy Award. Each week, the show features a group of quirky episodes on a theme. It's been described as movies for radio, and now This American Life is about to become radio for TV. The cable network Showtime is producing This American Life. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Ira Glass back to my show today. Hello, Ira.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. You're not leaving radio, are you? Not after Time Magazine called you the best radio host in America?
Yeah, and a outrageous slap against Howard Stern. I feel like I won that unjustly. But no, not leaving radio at all. No, we've been producing new shows for the last – basically, we moved our show to New York City in order to – start television production. We moved from Chicago, and it just was easier to do the TV production if we were here in New York. And so since April, we've been doing radio shows, and we've been working on the television show both, and that continues for another month.
Have you found that the qualities of a good story are the same or different for TV and for radio?
I mean, a lot of this stuff is the same. I mean, for a story to work on our show, whether it's the TV show or the radio show, there has to be somebody in a surprising situation. They have to be somebody who we can relate to. And then you know, we have to watch them or listen to them go through a bunch of stuff and see how they feel at each stage and see how they change and what they learn. I mean that part is the same. The part that's different is just, you know, we wanted the TV show to be ambitious visually. You know, we wanted to use the fact that we had pictures to do something. And so the people, our director and our cinematographer, they created a look for the thing that's just beautiful. It's shot like a movie in widescreen, and it's just beautifully lit. And so we've selected stories for the television show where there's just interesting stuff to look at that you can film in an interesting way.
Visual clips instead of sound clips?
I mean, yeah. Exactly.
What about reenactments? Are you doing that? And are you narrating as you have on the radio show?
I and our other contributors narrate, that part is like the radio show. And what was the other question?
Well, reenactments.
I mean, no reenactments. No, I mean in one of the stories that we did for our pilot, we did a thing where a woman tells a story from her childhood in a very stylized way. We try to recreate the scene of her childhood. And in one of the stories, Chris Ware does a cartoon version of a story that a guy remembers from his childhood. But that's pretty much it. Overwhelmingly, we're in places where stuff is happening and you see it happen.
You are not appearing in it. Why? You're a decent-looking fellow.
Actually, I do appear in it.
Oh, you do? Well, not in the pilot that I've received.
Yeah. Well, it took us a while to figure out, like, how I should appear, actually. And that was a huge puzzle. And truthfully, we went through every idea. And at the beginning, we thought, well, maybe I shouldn't appear. And then it just seemed a little artsy or something. You know what I mean? Like, it seemed weird. It seemed anti-pop, or it seemed like, you know, it seemed to not have the kind of normalcy and friendliness that the radio show has. You know, it's just weird if the host of the TV show just never appears. It seems like a really weird choice.
Especially since everyone else is appearing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I will remain behind the curtain. Me, the terrible Oz.
Well, lose your anonymity when people start recognizing you on the street because they saw you on TV.
Yeah, there's no upside to that. So we invented a thing. Like it was hard. I mean, truthfully, that was the hardest. That was one of the hardest problems to solve. Is like, where am I? Because everything had been done. You know, if you put me on a set, it looks like a TV news magazine. And if you put me in a sort of black void, then it's the Charlie Rose show. Or like, should I walk on at the end of each story and cross my arms and look like Rod Serling and sum it all up? And which actually I think would have been kind of fun to do, but we decided that was a little corny. And we invented this thing where at some point Chris, our director, he's like the woman who's doing the art design and the design for the shows, he's like, all right, like when you get your own TV show, like what do they give you? What's the first thing they give you? They give you a desk. And so we're going to get you a desk. You know, Leno's got a desk. Letterman's got a desk. Jon Stewart's got a desk. We're going to get you a desk. It's going to be one of those TV desks. But the desk is just going to go everywhere. So some week, you know, so the one week, you know, you're announcing the show from like the lip of the Grand Canyon. And the next week you're in the oil fields. And the next week, you know, you're on a factory floor and beams are swinging by you.
But always with the desk.
Always with the desk. And the desk has got a mug and there's like the microphone on the desk and the blue cards and there's pencils, which we don't even know what you use the blue cards for when you're hosting a TV show. But there they are. And like and wherever you go. And so it's like that. There was this art project a couple of years ago where they had this red couch that guys would just take across the country everywhere. And it's got a little bit of that in it. And I don't know. So that's
so you're doing that?
Yeah, we're doing it. No,
you're gonna have
shout out on the salt flats. You know, we have a desk. And
well, I understand that when you moved from NPR to Chicago Public Radio, that was one of the things that you specified. You wanted a desk and a soundproof studio. So desks
yes,
have been very important to you.
I don't know. Call me a sort of traditional sort of worker. I believe that I will need a desk to work at, yes.
But why did you ask for that when you went to BEZ? Had the people at NPR told you horror stories about local stations?
Well, BEZ, I went to BEZ where they went through a thing that was similar to what NYC has gone through, where they became independent of the city. And they had just become independent of the Chicago Board of Education, which was ranked as one of the worst performing school systems in the country pretty consistently for about 15 years. And so they had sort of gotten their license away from the board, and they were still kind of ragtag operation, and they did not have a single soundproof studio. So when we started This American Life, I had been working as an NPR producer and reporter. I was just like, this has to be part of the deal that like you will give us desks. There will be there will be computers. The computers will work. There will be a studio. It will be soundproof. It was a very suspicious little contract, which in retrospect is kind of funny to read because they you know that's the point where they sort of turned into a modern public radio station and started making new shows. And After Us came Wait, Don't Tell Me, and you know they severely like upgraded everything they did and built a new facility, and they've been pretty wonderful actually.
It's been my experience that people are often stunned when they see people they think they know from the radio in person.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with television when people when viewers see these people for the first time and they don't look the way they imagined them? Could you have used actors?
I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Playing Ira Glass will be
the real. Yeah. Here's David Sedaris as David would like to have somebody play him.
I suppose so. I mean, I feel like we all would. I mean, you know, like I'm in my 40s. You know, I don't think there's anybody really like you know in their mid 40s or older who relishes the idea of being filmed and put on TV. I mean, what do I think will happen? I mean, we do a lot of live shows. You know, I go out and promote our radio show and go on stage in front of, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people. And in that situation where people see me, they're very polite about it. And I feel like I just simply hope that it will be the same once I'm on TV.
The radio show has taken a more political turn in the last few years with stories from people in Iraq. And you covered the suffering from Katrina. Will the TV show venture into that kind of territory as well?
I mean, there's nothing preventing it. The problem is the lead time on the television stories is so long that it's hard to do stuff that will still be current. The one thing that we tried to prepare that we were going to do for television, we had prepared and did all this research and worked up an hour about Congress where we felt like in researching it, we were hearing stories of basically what it's like to really work in Congress and what really happens in Congress and committees that most of us have never heard of and just all kinds of stuff that most of us never heard of. Like, for example, did you know that since Newt Gingrich, they only work 3 days a week?
Really?
Yeah.
Newt had them working longer, or he's the reason he shortened the week?
he shortened the week to 3 days, and he said, go back to your districts. And actually, that has all sorts of consequences. So there's no time for oversight committees. There's no time for all sorts of things. And then old-time congressmen say, like, well, that's one of the reasons why it's so bitter is because nobody knows anybody. You know, you come in for 3 days. You have three hurried days of work, and then you leave. And so a lot doesn't get done, especially oversight of the budget, like which used to, you know, they used to have hearings which would last for days and weeks on something like the defense budget. And literally now they just have to cram it through. And so, you know, and people told us just amazing individual stories. And we went down and we shot and we spent a lot of Showtime's money actually shooting. And then it was one of those things where we could not get the access. We couldn't get the access to the committees. We couldn't be allowed to film on the floor of Congress, even when Congress wasn't in session. We just really got stumped for things to look at. And so that's something we'll end up just doing on the radio. So
Borat can gain access to Congress, but This American Life can't.
I don't know how that bastard did it. No.
The radio show will celebrate its 11th anniversary on November 17th. And the American Journalism Review wrote that the show is at the vanguard of journalistic revolution. It's probably the most imitated radio format, at least in public radio. What was it like getting it started? Was it unique at that time? Were you imitating anybody?
I mean, I wasn't imitating anybody, but I mean, I feel like I come out of a tradition of a certain kind of work that was being done on the regular NPR daily news shows.
Were you producing David Sedaris' pieces for Morning Edition?
I was, yeah. And there's always been, you know, in public radio, there's been this tradition of, you know, once a day on All Things Considered, a Morning Edition, there'll be a story by some producer where it's more of a narrative, where the characters are more three-dimensional and there are funny moments and emotional moments. Like, you know, there'll be one story like that. And there's some great producers, Joe Richmond's here in New York, and Jay Allison, and, you know, it's just David Isay, who's here in New York. Like, there's a bunch of people who do that work.
And Joe Frank had been doing it for years at
Joe
BAI
Frank,
and
yeah.
Then in San Francisco.
Absolutely. And Los Angeles, actually,
oh, Los
yeah. And yeah,
I lost track of him when he left New York.
Yeah. And so there's a tradition of that. I think there was that. We were the first ones to actually just put it together as a weekly show. And for that, I mean, at the time that we went on the air, we were not seen as a good bet. And our business plan called for, you know, the hopeful idea that we would be on 60 stations at the end of 2 years. Like, we really just thought, like, well, if we could just get on some major markets, we'd be okay. And I mean, as it turned out, like, the public radio system was very much ready for us, and we sold very hard. And we were on 200 stations by the end of like 12 or 14 months.
And
like,
now
we, like,
500.
We did very, very well.
Now
yeah,
500, yeah. An audience estimated over 1.75 million, but yeah. NPR turned you down. Have they issued an apology since?
Yeah. I mean, when we started, we were basically, you know, the show was designed as it would come out of WBEZ and it would be a national show. But the way the public radio system works is that you can kind of, anybody can buy time on the public radio satellite, and you just have to talk stations into running you. And so that's what we did, and we didn't have a distributor like NPR, the network organization that makes Morning Edition and All Things Considered and all those other shows. They didn't distribute us, and there would be all sorts of advantages to them distributing us, and we tried to talk them into it. And I had worked at NPR since I was 19. I was 37 when the show started, and knew everybody, like literally knew everybody. And in a certain way, that worked against me because they all, I think, thought of me as like that kid who grew up here in the hallway. And the people on the news staffs were huge supporters of it. I remember Robert Siegel and Ellen Weiss, who was the producer of All Things Considered, and a bunch of like sort of a lot of the people I'd worked with in the past, you know, went to the NPR brass and kind of said, like, this show is a continuation of what we do. This is NPR, basically. This is the next generation of NPR. Like, this has to be part of our company. And just literally the people who ran NPR's programming division at the time, they just didn't get the show. They just didn't understand it. They didn't see what was good about it. And there were a couple things that were a problem, and one of them was just me. They just felt like, well, this – there was a feeling of like – you know, I'd been a reporter for years at that point. There was a feeling of like, well, I was a really good reporter, but like, here's the show. Like, when's the guy with the deep voice going to come on and announce the stories? Like, where's the real voice of authority that's at the heart of an
Robert
NPR
Siegel
show?
You should have brought him along with you.
Well, he would do a very fine job, actually. He's a wonderful,
or
you know,
Carl
he's
Castle.
Great. Exactly. Great guys. Love those guys. But, you know, we couldn't afford them at the time, and so we were stuck with me. And you had already
filled in as host of Weekend All Things Considered, and
yes.
You'd also done Talk of the Nation. So
yes.
you had proved yourself. I mean, I think this is partly forgive me for saying this because we're on an NPR affiliate, and I love NPR, and I think it's the best in radio. At the same time, there is a certain safeness that we've seen over the years, and then other people have to do something, prove it, break a story, and then suddenly NPR is ready to jump on it.
I mean, we were in the weird position where at the point where we went to NPR, we had been on the air for a year. We were on in 7 out of 10 major markets. We were fully funded. We had won the Peabody Award. And they still wouldn't pick us up. And we just felt like, what do we have to do? Like we've done all the work. We've created the show. Like, people love us, you know, and they still didn't want it. I just feel like, in a way, I respect it. Like honestly, like, the programmers who were in charge, they just didn't like it. They just didn't get it, and they didn't like it. And at some level, like, you can't argue with that.
Well,
you know?
They were wrong, Ira. Well, we have to take a little break. We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more. I also want to talk about your CDs and some of the other things. And, of course, we'll look more into your past, which includes some mysterious lost moments. My guest is Ira Glass, and this is New York Public Radio, WNYC. And we are back with Ira Glass. Ira, we asked our listeners.
We've changed clothes. I just want to point out that during that little break, we changed clothes. We're in a completely different room.
Actually,
we look completely different. It's just it's costume changes. You should see. The set is all different.
And I think of it as all part of the same kind of programming. I want those pledge breaks to be as entertaining as the regular show, which, in fact, I shouldn't even call it the regular show. I want it to be as entertaining as the rest of the show. And if they're not, then it either means that the rest of the show isn't all that entertaining, or
I know that transition though is so funny. That transition was so like, and now to Leonard Lopate back in the main room, and then like music plays, and you run to the main room, and you turn on the microphone, and you're out of breath, and then I'm like, thank you, Leonard. You know, it's very like. Anyway, I'm sorry.
It's okay. We asked our listeners which shows aside from This American Life they would want to see on television. Number one, what do you think?
I have no idea.
Wait, don't tell me. Then Car Talk. Fresh Air was tied for number two with Car Talk. And then Radiolab got a vote or two. On the Media got a vote or two. And pretty much everything else you could imagine got a vote or two. But wait, don't tell me, really. And I think that's very clever, because I think that would lend itself to interesting TV, don't you? It's got so many different elements.
I mean, it's a real show. You know, I mean, now that they're in front of a live audience, you feel like, hey, it's a show. You know, you can totally imagine it as a TV thing with a live audience. Sure.
You studied semiotics in college. Were you interested in going into radio even then?
Yeah. By the time I was studying semiotics, I had already been working at NPR and didn't know I was going to stay with radio, but just thought I would keep doing something in broadcasting or making stories or something.
Well, you were interning at NPR. What did you think you would do if you stayed in radio? Did you think you'd go on the air?
No, actually, no. Because I was not any good on the air. It took me a long time to learn how to write effectively for radio, and I didn't voice my stories very well. I spent the first 10 years of my time in radio never going on the air. And in fact, when I started doing stories, they were the kind of stories where the reporter edits out, you know, all of his questions, and there's no narration, and you just hear the person tell a story. I was very much not wanting to get on mic.
I have a faint memory of you at WNYC for a while, working on a kid show called Small Things Considered.
Yeah, and then Kids America. I was living in New York for about a year in the 80s, and I got pulled into that. That was fun. That was actually the one time I was on the air where I felt like I knew what I was doing.
I guess that was preparation for Small Things Considered to Weekend All Things Considered. We had to change the name because NPR got really upset that we were knocking off that name. And Kids America, I think, worked well really worked well. And I think it's sad that we don't have that show anymore. That was a terrific show.
Yeah.
And then you also served as host of Talk of the Nation after John Hockenberry left. That had to have been a real stretch for you, but you did very well, I thought.
That's nice of you to say. I mean, I always felt like I feel like I tried to do a decent job, but I feel like everything about doing live radio, everything about it didn't play to the stuff that I was good at, I thought. I feel like on our show, on This American Life, and in my work as a reporter, like a lot of the most interesting stuff, you know, we would get to, or I would get to it with the interviewees only after talking to them for an hour or two and digressing and letting things digress in a way that you simply cannot do on live radio. It has to be always interesting. And so the moments that I find the most interesting and the emotional moments and things like that, which you can get to in a taped interview, it was just really hard to make happen in a live interview. And I feel like, in a way, like my instincts were always against it. And I don't know. Like I feel like I did okay. There were definitely times when I felt like, I don't know how this happened. Like because I was host of Talk of the Nation, I was the host for NPR's live 5-hour coverage of the Clinton inaugural, where every 15 minutes, like, first Daniel Schorr is sitting across from me, and then Christopher Hitchens, and then, you know, Roger Wilkins, and like all these like super famous, you know, people, and you know, one after another, and we're listening to the speeches, and it was such a weird, you know, that you have these moments in your life where you think like, well, maybe this is who I'm going to be, like maybe this is who I am, and you try.
I'm going to be Daniel Schorr,
kind of like maybe that's where I'm heading, and when that job ended, I was there for 4 or 5 months, and suggested that there was a guy in Chicago who I thought would be good, who then got the job, Ray Suarez. Suggested him for the job. I was very glad to go back to my regular life.
Well, how did you connect with the people who you have put together for This American Life? David Sedaris, you were producing his pieces on NPR, but how did you even make that connection?
I mean, David was somebody, like when I was living in Chicago, he was somebody who was just reading in little, you know, clubs and stuff. And so there was a little performance scene, and the Chicago performance scene, in contrast to the New York one, was very, what's the word? It's very entertainment oriented. Like people really were out to entertain in the performance scene. And so David was like a number of people who you would go to these little clubs and people would put together shows. And, you know, one of the acts would be like this guy, David Sedaris, who hadn't published any books and hadn't published anything. And he would come up and read a story. And it really, like, even back then, before he was a published writer, everything that is present in his work now was present then. It had a really clear voice. It was really funny. And it had, you know, all of his work has a certain emotional quality to it that you don't find in a lot of funny writing. Like all of that was there at the beginning, and also like you could. I remember like listening to him the first time and thinking, God, this guy would be really great on the radio because he's a great reader and the stuff is really original. And then the speed at which the anecdotes happened, because I was a radio producer, I knew like it happened at just the right speed that you could actually put it on the radio. Like some writers are really great, but their stories don't resolve fast enough. You know what I mean? Like they don't hit their plot points quite quick enough that you can easily translate them to the radio. Whereas David, it was instantly apparent the first time I heard him that he would be great on the radio.
And then there's the other David and Sarah.
There's David Rakoff and yeah. Sarah. I mean, a lot of these people came to us. Like David Rakoff had heard the show and was writing and came to us. Sarah Val, you know, came by and was writing a book about radio and then had an idea for a story. I mean, I wish I could say that we were such geniuses in spotting talent that we're going out in the world. The truth is, like, a lot of people found us.
But the sense is that most of the stories on This American Life are based on the truth. They may have been enhanced a bit. Is that one?
I mean, the ones, you know, I feel like when you have like somebody like David Sedaris, like basically you kind of know there's little notes of exaggeration for comic effect, but most of the rest of it is pretty much straight reporting. I mean, we fact check it. I mean, it's real.
Oh, you do? Because people no longer trust memoirs to be true. We've had a number of scandals. They're not even sure that the news is always the truth. And you've confessed to saying untrue things on the air just for effect.
Well, but that's just to be funny. Like, I feel like when I say untrue things on the air, it's totally just, you can tell, hopefully, I'm making a joke. You know, like I don't know. Like, there was a point, the time when I realized, like, somebody might take it seriously, we did a story about this place called Medieval Times in Chicago. And we went there with a medieval scholar named Michael Camille and just to get his critique on like how are they doing it. And it's a really funny story because he's incredibly he was incredibly dear man and he loved it. He thought it was tremendously inauthentic, but in a way that was absolutely authentic, actually. And anyway, so in the course of that story, I'm talking about the medieval times chain, and at some point, I sort of say, look at the size of this operation. It's like 200 people, and it's horses, and it's jousting, and you know, the number of people who come through here is something like 400,000-500,000 a year. And I said, I work for a radio station whose audience is actually only 300,000, and we've only got 40 employees, which leads me to the unfortunate conclusion that I work for a medium that is less popular than jousting, a sport that has been dead for 900 years, which I'm just saying to be funny, right? Saying to be funny, and years go by, literally years after that story, and I'm in an idle conversation with one of our producers, then Elise Spiegel, and we're talking about whatever the show, and she's feeling depressed about this or that with the show, and she's like, well, in the end, what we do, we're no more popular than jousting, and I was like, Elise, that was just a joke. Yes, they have 400,000 people and we have 300,000, but we have 300,000 every day. You know what I mean? That was just being funny. And it never had occurred to me that anybody was taking it seriously, much less one of my fine producers.
My guest is Ira Glass, who earlier reminded us that he is a real admirer of Howard Stern. What do you admire about him?
So it's a really great radio show. He's emotionally present. He's funny. He's smart. You can't tell how it's going to shake out. Those of us who love Howard, what we love about Howard is we actually love him. We love him. We love the personalities of the people on there. I feel like my feelings about Artie and Robin and the other characters are just very straightforward. Like on a favorite TV show. I love them. And I think that people who don't listen to Howard get put off or don't get past the girls taking off their tops when really I think for those of us who listen all the time, that's actually the smallest and least important part of the show. Like what it's about is it's a group of people and they just get along and they're interesting to listen to talk. And it's a beautifully, beautifully formatted show. If you think about the problem of doing 5 hours of radio, I had a friend who said basically what Howard does is it's the format of the Jack Benny show. It's a very, very old radio format where they just create one situation after another, and then every one of our familiar characters reacts to the situation. You get to see each person's personality kind of come into play, with each situation that they create. Since they've been on Sirius, I got to say, that is the happiest show on radio. It's just gotten better and better.
Well, you've also said he's a great radio interviewer, and I was thinking whether I should take tips, whether I should start asking my female guests whether they're wearing panties and things like that.
I mean, he is actually a great interviewer. Do you listen? Have you heard him?
Well, not lately? Since he moved to Sirius, because this show is on XM, and I have to maintain my loyalty.
Yeah, I understand that. No, but he's a great interviewer. I mean, he had J.J. Abrams, the guy who created Lost, on. And he asked him this question. I thought, that is exactly the question you want to hear. He asked him, how many people know what's going on that island? How many people? Is it two? Is it just you and your co-creator? Does your wife know? I don't know. There's something about him where he's good at his job.
Well, you've written that you have a recurring dream that Howard Stern is disappointed in you, that you never live up to his standards. And
yes.
I guess when the first time I read that, I thought, what standards are we talking about?
Yeah.
Have you spoken to your therapist about what that dream means?
I feel like, I am not a trained psychologist, but I feel like even I can tell what that dream means. And, I think he does a great show and no joke about it. And, I feel like on a good day, we live up to the standard that Howard is setting for all of us.
You've said that you don't like radio drama. What do you mean by radio drama? Would War of the Worlds have been a disappointment to you?
I mean, War of the Worlds actually is performed in a way that I like. I mean, for me, the thing that I don't like is I think a lot of people – I mean, I feel like when I hear the radio dramas, they all seem very creaky. And when I hear people doing it today, it just sounds like somebody doing it from the 1940s. Like they do it in a very over-dramatic style that I don't think works for those of us who grew up going to the movies and watching TV, where we're used to sort of smaller performances. And interestingly, I mean, there is this guy, Joe Frank, who you mentioned earlier in the hour. And I feel like the thing that Joe Frank invented, and if people haven't heard him, if you just Google his name, Joe Frank, you can find his stuff on the web, all of his old shows. He invented this way to do radio drama where it actually felt like a contemporary thing, where he would basically give the actors plot points that they were going to hit, and he'd have them improv for, say, an hour, and then he'd edit it down so it sounded completely natural. That is, it sounds like somebody doing a documentary. The people sound like they talk in a normal way. And when you hear what he does and compare it to the sort of people, reading lines, from a script and sound effects, which can be funny in a kind of kitschy way, like on Prairie Companion, like it's fun to listen to, but not in a way that you're taking the drama seriously. It's just fun because it's sort of kitschy. Compared to that, the Joe Frank stuff seems so much more alive and able to kind of pierce to your heart more.
I understand one of the stories from This American Life, Unaccompanied Minors, is coming out in December, isn't it, as a movie?
We are seizing every medium, Leonard.
Yeah, you're writing a book as well, aren't you? Adapting a book of Ethan Waters for the movies?
I wrote a screenplay, and then this movie is coming out. This kid's movie is coming out based on a story from our show. Warner Brothers is putting it out as a December Christmas release, and the TV show in February.
When does the Showtime show begin?
Well, we think it's still a bit up in the air because they're still juggling around their schedule. It'll be sometime in early 2007, possibly as early as January, but probably February or maybe as late as April. We actually should know that in a couple of days.
We have a clip from the Hope and Fear collection. Maybe you can set it up for us. It's the thing about the guy who's thrilled he's got an apartment. Thrilled about the apartment he's just gotten in New York until he
yes.
sees his apartment on the Bachelorette reality show.
Yeah, yeah. He's just moved to New York. He feels like, I've got this great apartment and on the Lower East Side, and real New Yorkers tell him it's a great apartment. And then he's watching The Bachelorette, and they're in New York for that week, and he just thinks to himself, and then they get in the car at the end of the date, and he just thinks he'd be so excited if he could recognize some place. You know what I mean? He just moved to New York. And then they get out of the car, and they're on his block. Like, the guy is walking to the building, and it's his building. Like, there's his entranceway to his, like, little Lower East Side building. And I don't know where you're picking up
Well,
this
don't
story.
Give away too much.
Okay. He watches them take the elevator up to the fourth floor. Jorge lives on the fifth. They walk down the hall to a door. And then Jorge realizes something else.
He doesn't just live in the city as me. He doesn't live on the same street as me. He doesn't just live in the same building as me. He basically lives in my apartment. He lives in the exact same apartment. It's the exact same layout.
So wait a second. So the camera goes inside this apartment, and you see your apartment, basically.
A much better version of my apartment. His is much better. The walls are whiter. The place is cleaner. The furniture is nicer. He has a half wall. He's got a half wall.
A half wall with them brick glass
it's
blocks.
Like, it's like drywall, but it seems like it has like some sort of like countertop kind of thing on it.
And at that moment, Jorge gets this flash. He is not really doing all that well. His apartment is a kind of dump compared to this guy who's on TV. Plus, he's watching Trista Wren, the Bachelorette, on TV, looking uncomfortable in his apartment on national TV. In fact, she bails on the guy.
She leaves the apartment, and they cut to like that head-on interview, mm-hmm. And she's just looking into the camera, and she says, "I've dated guys with really bad apartments before. I can't judge him on that. I have to find out why he feels like he can live in an apartment like this."
She ditched him because of the apartment?
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, he lost out on The Bachelorette because of the apartment?
Oh yeah.
And it was your apartment?
But better.
Ira.
He was collateral damage to a reality show.
It's interesting the way you've adapted the radio form to the television form. I can pretty much see it in my head, which I think...
No, that's nice of you to say.
Well, I can, although I am curious to see just how bad that apartment is. Is that going to be in the thing as well? Are
no,
we going to see that?
Oh,
too bad.
No.
Well, we've come to the end of this segment, and now we're going to run into the other room, change our clothes.
All right. Seriously, is there going to be music? All right, now switching over to you, Leonard Lopate in Pledge Central. Is there going to be music?
Yeah, there'll be music. There'll be people doing funding credits, the whole thing. You know, I mean, this is public radio, isn't it? And
yes.
And it's what people love. I mean, I love it. I wouldn't want it to be any different.
I'm for the system. Like, I feel like, you know, if people are listening, you know, and thinking like, oh, they've never given money and should they give money? Like, the thing I would say is, like, this system, like, as weird as it is, it's actually an incredibly fair system. You know, the system is, like, those of us who like these shows, you know, we put up the money and we pay for them. And if you think about that and compare it to the idea of, like, what happens in commercial broadcasting where, you know, you can get as many as 20 minutes per hour of commercials. And so you're basically paying with a third of your life. You know, I prefer this.
And we'll come back with more of that sort of thing right after this as we change our clothes. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.